And now with me in the studios here at the SDPB Studios, the University of South Dakota, we have Mr. Frank Pommersheim. And welcome, sir. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me, Lori. It's a pleasure.
Law professor at the university, author of a variety of nonfiction books, but we're closing out National Poetry Month in April here, so we asked you to come in and talk a little bit about haiku, because I was over at the USD bookstore and found these small in trim size treasures of haiku poetry of yours.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Tell me when you started writing haiku and how it sort of fits into your overall writing life.
Yes, somehow I became interested at some point in trying to write poetry that was shorter and more concentrated than ordinary American poetry. And I had stumbled on and began to read some haiku, and I was very taken by it as a form and what it tries to do. And so I began to take a look in that direction in terms of seeing if I could develop, in terms of things I wanted to say, a very kind of concentrated style. And it worked for me in terms of my own satisfaction in actually doing it, and the response from from people who read my stuff, from students, from people in the community, people in Native communities, was very, very positive. So I was encouraged to continue to go in that direction.
Did you spend a lot of time studying sort of the origins of it? Did you just start with an American version of haiku and then do what you wanted to do?
Well, I think originally I became conscious of the form. It's an essential Japanese form that developed in the 16th and 17th century, and has the basic three-line format of five syllables in the first line, seven in the second, and then five again. And it has kind of a particular function in traditional Japanese haiku to have kind of this notion of a concentrated expression that creates a number of associations and hopefully gets the attention of the reader for him or her to engage with what they are actually taking from the poem. And for reasons I probably can't explain, I found that sort of a resonant way for me to think about poetry and to try to start to go in that direction.
Are there thematic boundaries? Is it boundaryless as far as what subjects you can tackle?
Well, in typical American fashion, people have gone beyond sort of the Japanese confines. I think the original kind of strictures in Japanese haiku poetry was mostly kind of a focus on nature and the energy that is released when in certain images that come from nature. But in the context of the way it's been picked up in America, there's a lot of that as well, but people have been applying it, including myself, to all sorts of different situations.
All right. How many collections do you have published that people can
Well, the two recent ones which you have here in the studio are these these chapbooks that deal with, they're called the Buddha Correspondence. The first one is Small is Beautiful, and the second one is Local Memory and Karma. And then I have three earlier volumes, which are a beginning mix of just sort of lyrical poetry and some of my initial haikus.
Right. How broad-based is your poetry as a whole? Do you branch out beyond haiku? Is this sort of where you focus your energy?
Well, I would say I branched out from haiku because many of the poems in those Buddha chapbooks are not technically haiku. They're very short. They're very concentrated, but many of them don't follow the 17-syllable, three-line rule. And I have found myself that expanding the haiku form at least slightly in the context of these Buddha poems, I mean, the whole Buddha thing, which is a strange and important but funny thing to me, the Buddha has become kind of a vehicle to express a lot of different kind of feelings and emotions and perceptions. And I know the response from people who have read the chapbooks, my students. I have this Buddha mailing list, which I periodically send out some Buddha poems, and that list is about 400 people. And there's been a lot of really positive response to to the Buddha persona in many of the poems.
Where did that come from, sort of adopting the Buddha persona?
Well, I think I just kind of stumbled on it. I have some interest in Buddhism and how I understand, however imperfectly, the figure of Buddha, that he embodies a lot of kind of contradictory things about being serious but not being serious, being spiritual, but also being secular, being political and not being political. And so it was kind of the balance of these opposite kind of qualities that were attractive to me. And, you know, as a writer, as a poet, you're never sure what a reader will make of the stuff. And so although I was satisfied with them myself, I had a little trepidation in terms of reading them and putting them out. And so people might just think, no, it doesn't work. And fortunately, people have been very, at least people who have articulated to me, have been very positive in their responses.
All right. Yeah. Would you read for us for a moment? Is it challenging to sort of do a reading of very short work?
It is in a way, but I've given a number of poetry readings, and it's a matter of pacing. But generally, the response has been, you know, I think very positive. So I'll just read a few, just picking up with local memory and karma. The first poem is called Buddha Goes Hiking in Old Age. Buddha Goes Hiking in Old Age. In the distance, only distance, water, weather, walking stick. And I once had read this poem at a poetry reading, and the person said, and she had read it before, and she said, that poem was perfect. It's just like it is when I go take a hike, and she was a young person. So for me, you know, it's very powerful to get a reflection from someone that you've articulated, something you've articulated in a poem is very resonant with their own experience.
Let's talk about that word perfect, because that's something that's often associated with haiku as a form. It seems like it's attainable, that perhaps you could achieve perfection at using that form in poetry. Do you think? Do you think that you can achieve perfection?
Well, I use the word perfection. Probably Buddha is probably smiling because I probably used it in an ill-advised way, because I think there is no such thing as a perfect form. I think the key is in writing haiku in particular, where the strict form is very much of a given. And it's just how well you can not only meet those formal requirements, but how kind of resonant that is to a reader, because when a reader or a listener hears you read a poem, they're probably not paying a lot of attention initially to whether you have met the formal requirements of the poem, but what are they hearing? Is it something that they can relate to? Is there certain imagery, is certain ways of expression, certain metaphors that you use, at least the first go-around, that people really, you know, they connect with it? And I think, for me, for reasons I can't explain, that's what I... how I want to approach things, maybe because I'm also a law professor and a scholar. I write also very different long things. So I'm interested, I think, on the poetic side of maybe the opposite of sort of long, important, but very lengthy, heavily footnoted kind of things. Can I say things in short compass and connect with people? And so I think in part that's my goal. If I could, I read another poem, and this is sort of more political. I always ask my students when I read this poem, how many of you have heard of Dorothy Day? And unfortunately, my students at the law school almost uniformly have never heard of Dorothy Day. And Dorothy Day is a very famous writer and activist, the founder of the Catholic Worker, and now being considered for sainthood. And so Dorothy Day was a very powerful figure in my own kind of development about sort of putting together in a very humble way how you actually serve people from a particular religious tradition, but also have a commitment to political activity. She was very active, very much engaged in nonviolent resistance against the Vietnam War and other violent activities. And so this is a short poem that tries to kind of capture that. And it's called Buddha Marches for Peace with Dorothy Day. Buddha marches for peace with Dorothy Day. Arm in arm against the drones, loaves and fishes, but never stones.
How does, how has the process of sort of creating haiku, reworking a poem, sharing it with others, impacted you in your work as a law professor?
It's a good question. I would say the following in the context of the Buddha poems, and oftentimes in my classes at the law school, I usually begin every class with a Buddha poem, prefacing it at the beginning of the semester. I'm going to read a poem at the beginning of every class that probably doesn't objectively fit with what we're actually going to be talking about in class, but maybe it does. And I know from reading student evaluations or talking to students, they really like the poems. They add something to the class that maybe they themselves can't quite articulate. And so I find that in a subjective way very, very encouraging. I also have people in the field of being a law professor, particularly in the Indian law area, who have seen a lot of my work and have oftentimes commented about how much they appreciate my contribution of poetry to the law. Because I think in many ways poetry can illuminate part of the law. And I take that as a good marriage, a good relationship where poetry can meet law. Because if you ask most people, and maybe I even detected it on the expression on your own face, is that that's a strange kind of connection. And it is, but I think it's an important and necessary connection. And so it's been a very kind of wonderful putting stuff together because people seem to appreciate it and think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
So I raise my eyebrows because I want there to be a strong connection between poetry and the law, and I'm not thinking of anything, nothing comes to my mind of other connections. Is there a strong tradition of those two intersecting?
No. There's definitely not a strong tradition of those connections. Have people always been striving to do that? And maybe more so in recent times? I definitely think so. I mean, you know, it reflects sort of the larger problem. Obviously, poetry and law are part of the humanities, but I think for most people, both outside the profession and inside the profession, they don't see that there's much convergence between the two. And I think it's worth exploring that potential convergence, or at least putting something out there and having people have the opportunity to think about whether it converges in that way for them.
Have you ever taught a workshop or brought in, for law students to study poetry formally or encourage them to do so?
Well, yes. I'm a teacher. I love teaching. I don't want to teach poetry.
Right.
It's something I do. It's not something I teach. And so if someone would ask, I love being on the program. I love giving poetry readings and explaining a little bit about where I'm coming from as a poet. But what I want to teach poetry now, it's interesting because at the law school, I think largely because of some of my own work, we've had a poetry contest for law students. And we've called it the Law School Haiku Lollapalooza. And I'm actually judging that competition. And that's like a small example of saying, here's what one person does, and just throwing it open to students, you know, on a totally voluntary basis. Do you want to jump in and try your hand at haiku? And the one condition that they had to follow, they had to write a haiku based on a case that they actually studied in one of their classes. So it was kind of bounded within the law. So you want to jump into this, just take a case that you've read in any of your classes and see if you can take what you thought was some interesting, important, funny, awful things from a case that you studied in one of your classes and see if you can kind of make it into a haiku. And I'm in the process of reading those. And it's just kind of a small but creative, fascinating thing to see law students kind of take a bit of a jump into taking legal materials and see if they can rework it into kind of a different mode of expression.
Makes them consider it more deeply.
Definitely. Yeah, right. And to think about how you can explain the law, communicate about cases, which are often very, very technical, in other forms. And for me, that's a critical skill for lawyers to have that many of us don't have, and that is how effectively can you communicate the stuff in the law, the language of the law, the cases that we read, to people who aren't lawyers? Mm-hmm. And poetry is one vehicle for doing that. And I think that's an important thing that we don't pay enough attention to in every profession. Every profession that I'm aware of has become increasingly specialized in its vocabulary. Even in the context of a lot of English scholarship, to me, I occasionally read some of that, I don't get it. And for me, if you can't read someone else's scholarship in a different discipline and get a basic understanding of it, that's problematic for me. Mm-hmm. And so poetry is one way of being a 11 in the heavy dough of of the law.
Would you read more for us, please?
Sure. This is a poem I think people in South Dakota are probably well aware of, Ted Kooser, mm-hmm. A former poet laureate and a wonderful person, wonderful poet. And so this poem imagines me giving a Buddha receiving a signed copy of Ted's most recent book at the South Dakota Festival of the Book. And so this is called Buddha Receives a Signed Copy of Ted Kooser's Splitting an Order at the South Dakota Festival of the Book. Buddha receives a signed copy of Ted Kooser's Splitting an Order at the South Dakota Festival of the Book. Shoulder to shoulder with plain words, prairie sky, simple and blue, compassion in the commonplace.
Frank Palmersheim, the books Small is Beautiful, Local Memory, and Karma are available at the USD bookstore now. That's where I picked mine up. And thank you so much for stopping by. Come back again.
I'd be delighted to. I really appreciate the invitation.